Twitter or online at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233 AH Monticello, streaming online at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm your host, Jason Dolt. Thank you so much for being here with me this evening. Coming up in the program, we'll get an update on local theater from Jessica Barkle and Nick Lopez. But first, we have a lot of news to go through in our area. And for that, we turn to Philip Pantuso, Managing Editor, Hudson Valley Bureau of the Times Union. Philip, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be with you.
So, first off, we want to talk, you have a story about a Saugerties man pleading guilty to burglary, but there's some other interesting aspects of this story. Can you tell us what this is about?
Yeah, so this was a case that was scheduled to go to trial, or jury selection anyway, was scheduled to begin on Monday, involving a burglary in Saugerties. And right before jury selection was scheduled to begin, the man who was charged, Kirk Schultes Jr., decided to plead guilty. We're not exactly sure why that happened, but it did. His co-defendant in the trial pleaded guilty last year to second-degree burglary as well, which is a felony, and was sentenced to 6 years in state prison. Now, why am I talking about a lone burglary charge? Because there's a different case that Kirk Schultes is associated with that is a lot more, I don't know if interesting is the word, but there's certainly more going on. So he is the father of a young girl who was reported missing in Tioga County, further upstate, in 2019. She was reported missing by her maternal grandparents, who had been given custody of her when Kirk Schultes and his wife lost custody. That girl was not found until 2.5 years later, when police found her hiding with her mom beneath a staircase, in a secret compartment that was built beneath a basement staircase in a residence that the father and the mother and Kirk Schultes' father all lived in Saugerties. So this was a big deal at the time. She was found in 2022, there was a lot of reporting on it at the time. And Kirk Schultes, the man who pleaded guilty to burglary, was also charged with a couple of crimes in that case. He and his wife had long been suspects in the girl's disappearance. Police had visited that residence a couple of times before, but they didn't have a search warrant, and Kirk Schultes denied knowing the whereabouts of the girl. Eventually, they did get a search warrant, searched the place, found the girl hiding in this basement stairwell. She was unharmed and in good health. It appears basically that they were somehow anyway, allegedly took her from her custodial parents, her grandparents, and brought her back to Ulster County. I mentioned that he has charges in that case. We are not exactly sure what the status of that case is. So initially, he was charged, all three adults actually, were charged with felony custodial interference and misdemeanor child endangerment. And they were arraigned in Saugerties Town Court. But yesterday, as I was trying to figure out what is the status of this case, I called Saugerties Town Court. They told me that those charges had been waived up to Ulster County Court last year. Well, the Ulster County Court Clerk and the Ulster County Clerk have no record of any movement in that case other than the mother. The charges against her were dismissed last year. The county district attorney's office is declining to provide any information about the status of the charges against the two men, including Kirk Schultes Jr., who had also been charged with burglary. And I should stress that the burglaries are unrelated. They occurred after the girl was found. It's certainly fishy, I think. The only thing the district attorney's office would tell me is that the prosecution is continuing. They're not even saying that the investigation is ongoing.
Just to be clear again, in the case of his missing daughter, Kirk Schultes Jr. was charged. You know that he was charged, but you don't even know what the charges were?
No, we know what the charges were. The charges were felony custodial interference, which he's interfering with the custodial parent of the child, which in this case was her maternal grandparent, maternal grandparents, and a misdemeanor child endangerment charge. So we know what the charges were, and we know that he was arraigned in town court, and we know that the charges were passed up to county court. We just don't know what's happened with the charges since then. There have been no other filings. There has not been a grand jury indictment that's been handed up. At least that's been announced or filed with the court clerk. And he's certainly not been arraigned again. And there's no case happening at the moment. Right. So, it's unclear if the last minute change in his plea in the burglary charge is related to this, but there's certainly going to be more that develops on that case, at least the child case. And I'll certainly be interested to see if they are somehow linked.
Yeah, and you're not seeing a connection between these cases now, and you're wondering if a connection will come up in at least the burglary. I'm curious if there's a connection in at least just the guilty plea, because he did plead guilty, and I'm wondering if that is part of a legal strategy. In the article in the Times Union, you have a picture of him, with his representation, so he's got a lawyer, and they pled mm-hmm. guilty.
Right. Yeah. And to be clear, I'm saying the same thing as you. Like, I don't think there's any relation between, and law enforcement is not alleging at this point anyway, any connection between the burglary and the missing child case. I'm wondering, I'll be curious to see if this last minute change in his burglary case is related at all to the seemingly ongoing prosecution against him for the child endangerment and custodial interference case. Because, as I said, this case was, the burglary case was going to go to trial. They were going to start jury selection on Monday, and he changed his plea to guilty.
Wow. All right, let's move on to an update on Central Hudson. Electric provider. Last time we spoke about Central Hudson, it was because they had a change in leadership on top. We went over that story a few weeks ago. Now they're starting to terminate people's electricity once again. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's back to bad news about Central Hudson. This week, they began sending out the first termination notices to residential customers in 4 years. So they had paused canceling any utility service during the pandemic, and then they continued to not cut any service as the utility dealt with the repercussions of the flawed rollout of its new billing system, which we have discussed at length. But they resumed this week sending termination notices to customers who were more than 2 months past due in their Kingston division, which encompasses northern and western Ulster County and the town of Neversink. And these notices, they don't terminate your service immediately. They give customers 2 months to comply, but if they don't comply within that time, meaning you don't make up your payments, then your service will be cut. And they say basically they need to do this as a way to both sort of get back to normal operations, particularly as they move toward doing monthly meter readings, which is another thing they're working on right now. They're going away from estimated readings and going to monthly readings across their whole service area. That's going to be a rollout across the different divisions. And, you know, a spokesman for the company told us that they need to do that this because they're owed about $150 million from residential and commercial customers who are more than who are in arrears on their accounts. Central Hudson said that about 25% of customers' accounts are at least 60 days overdue. And that amount, that $150 million that they say they're owed, is 15 times more than they were owed 4 years ago before, you know, they paused sending termination notices.
Okay, well, so it sounds like when they brought on new leadership, there was a sense that they wanted to get back to business, and this is part of their business, sounds like.
Yeah.
Okay, and now New York State is restricting dairy cattle imports. What's this related to?
Yeah, so I'm sure listeners will have heard or seen on the news about the avian flu outbreak that's happening right now. So this is a strain of avian flu H5N1 virus that is highly pathogenic, according to virologists. And, you know, most troublingly, I think, has leapt into different species. So usually when there's an avian flu outbreak, it really just impacts sort of domesticated birds, most notably chickens, and then sometimes it'll leap into wild birds. But this one is jumping into all kinds of different animals, and, you know, from bottlenose dolphins to there's a huge, like, die-off of sea lions in South America. It's also getting into all kinds of land mammals, including dairy cattle. So this week, the State Department of Agriculture and Markets put restrictions on New York State importing dairy cattle from 8 states that have reported outbreaks of the virus. This will include a ban on importing cattle from any premises where there is a confirmed case, and for any importation at all from any of the states, a certificate of veterinary inspection is required 10 days prior to the importation. The Agricultural Department also stressed that the virus doesn't pose a human threat, and pasteurized milk remains safe to consume. They're framing this essentially as a way of trying to limit the virus from making further inroads into New York State. Because often what happens in this case is, or in cases like this, is that when a farm has a confirmed case of this virus, they have to basically kill what normally would happen is they would kill all the chickens because that's where it used to spread. And the federal Ag Department would give them reimbursements for that. But the point is to try to keep it from spreading, right? So you can't, now it's spreading into all these different species. You can't exactly kill off everything in your farm, but you can limit and put restrictions on sending those animals across state lines and potentially spreading the virus that way.
Wow. All right. Well, thanks for letting us know about that. And now, also, maybe we're getting into some better news here. I heard that Ulster County has a nature bus. Is this a totally new service?
Yes, this is a new service, and this is definitely good news, especially for a beautiful day like today, even though it hasn't yet started yet. So this is a program that was actually initially announced by Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger at her State of the County address back in February, but it is going to officially start this weekend, and it's the Nature Bus. It's basically a free bus that will take Ulster County residents to natural landscapes and attractions across the county, from state parks to the walkway over the Hudson to Kingston Point Bridge and everywhere in between. It's an additional service, basically, of Ulster County Area Transit, UCAT, which is the county's bus service, which is already free. Former County Executive Pat Ryan made it free in 2022 using, I think, Inflation Reduction Act money. So UCAT service is already free. But these are going to be additional service that's going to run on Saturdays on a rotating basis, starting this Saturday, April 27th, through October 12th. And what I mean by a rotating basis is there's three routes that pick up in different places and take you to different natural parks and landscapes across the county. And the other cool thing about this is that while the bus is free, or the bus was already free, if you take the nature bus to, say, the Shawangunk Ridge or Minnewaska State Park or the Ashokan Rail Trail, or any of the state parks, actually, where, you know, you have to pay an entrance fee, you also get in for free. And that's because Ulster County Tourism is taking part in this as well. So it's a really cool initiative. Not all three routes run every Saturday. They're going to rotate. So, you know, anybody who's interested in riding needs to check the schedule. But it's a really cool program, and I think it will really bolster tourism to the many beautiful natural landscapes here in Ulster County.
Okay, and I'm seeing that the Nature Bus is online at participate.ulstercountyny.gov. So the county's website has more information there as well as the routes. And now, finally, one more thing we want to talk about is, well, here, you know, New York State, there's a housing crisis. We've been talking about the high housing crisis, especially for affordable housing, especially in our region, the, you know, suburban and rural areas outside of New York City and the tri-state area. You've got some news on more affordable housing coming to Ulster County. Is that right?
Yeah, this is in the town of Lloyd, and it's going to be a 57-unit affordable housing development, primarily for seniors who, you know, are in some ways uniquely squeezed by the affordable housing crisis in suburban and rural areas of upstate New York, in part because there have been so many zoning restrictions on the type of housing that gets built. You know, what ends up happening a lot of times is seniors will kind of just age in place in houses that may not be best suited to their mobility needs, or just maybe too much space now that maybe they have kids and they moved out. And so this is, you know, a housing complex that's going to have senior services and programming. It will be affordable, and it's getting paid for by a bunch of state funds. And RUPCO here in Ulster County is the supportive service provider. They, among many other initiatives that they have, they also operate senior housing at Landmark Place in Kingston, which is a huge senior housing complex in the former Kingston Almshouse. So it's going to be a while before this opens. They just broke ground this week. But it's going to be a $22 million development that will comprise a single three-story building with 57 one-bedroom apartments. And it's reserved for New Yorkers 62 and older, earning at or below 60% of the area median income.
Wow. So, you know, when you say 57 units, what does that mean? Like an apartment that means more than one or two people can live in there?
So it's 57 one-bedroom apartments. So probably not too many more than two. Certainly, you know, a married couple or partners could live in a one-bedroom apartment, but probably not too many more than that. I should also note that almost half, or a little more than half, actually, of those apartments are going to be specifically set aside for seniors who are experiencing homelessness, according to the governor's office.
All right. Well, Philip, I want to thank you once again for going over all this with us. We're talking with Philip Pantuso, managing editor for the Hudson Valley Bureau at Times Union. All the stories we've been talking about are up now at timesunion.com. Philip, until next week, thank you so much.
Take care.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get an update on the SUNY Sullivan Theater Program's 2023-2024 season. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Support comes from Catskill Brewery, brewing ales, lagers, and mixed fermentation beers in a LEED Gold certified building in Livingston Manor. Beer garden and food truck at exit 96 off Route 17. CatskillBrewery.com. From The Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new releases, film festivals, nostalgic screenings, live music events, and more. Information and schedule at CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hello, my name is John Gordon, and I host a music show right here on WJFF called Ramble Tamble. It airs every Thursday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. I love music, and I play all kinds of different music. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights 7 to 9, right here on WJFF.
Welcome back to The Local Edition. I'm your host, Jason Dole. SUNY Sullivan has a theater program, and they are announcing their most recent performances that are coming up, kicking off the 2023-2024 theater season at SUNY Sullivan in Loch Sheldrake. They're going to be performing Lope de Vega's Fuente of Una, The Sheepwell, which is a revolutionary classical Spanish play, and it's been adapted and directed by Jessica Lopez Barkle, and Jack Sibley's Drury's Fairview, and that's a 2019 Pulitzer Prize-winning piece directed by Nick Lopez. And Radio Catskill culture reporter spoke to both Barkle and Lopez earlier.
Fuente de Vega is one of the first revolutionary plays in that when we teach it in theater history or history in general, because it is somewhat famous on different sides, because it was a real thing that happened. And in the town of Fuente Ovejuna, which I think it's Fuente Abejuna in Spain now, but there's just pronunciations have changed. But in that actual town in Spain, they had a really horrible commander from the Order of the Calatrava. And he was raping the women, burning things, just a horrible, horrible man. So they, you know, they killed him.
Okay.
Yeah. No spoilers. And the amazing story about this is that when the Reyes Catalicos, Ferdinand and Isabel, found out about this, they sent the inquisitors, because that's what they did. And the inquisitors were torturing every member of the town, and every member of the town told them, when they asked who did it, they said Fuente Ovejuna. They blamed the town. It's this beautiful play that also highlights the power of women, because it was the women who really came to the men of the town and they said, you are sheep, you know, you need to fix this. And they fixed it in a way. To Ferdinand and Isabel's credit, they could have just decimated the town, but they said, well, since the whole town is throwing the whole town under the bus, then there's not much we can do.
Wow, that's quite a story.
Yeah. For us, we've been doing every other year a Golden Age of Spain play because of our Latinx community here in Sullivan County. And we have also always provided it in the original Spanish. And we've added some of the Spanish to the production. We're singing most or all of the songs in Spanish.
All the songs.
I think we're singing all the songs in Spanish.
All the songs.
So every year we've been doing one because there isn't a lot of performance-based research in this. And so there's a couple of places in the United States that do it. We're one of them. Another one is up at UMass Amherst, and another one is over at UCLA. And so we're kind of special that we have this tradition of doing it consistently. Some people do one-offs, and we've just decided that that's a thing that's in our community, and it's a thing that's a part of our home life and our beliefs that there are other Shakespeares in our canon of literature. You know, there's Kalidasa, which we're also doing as a kids' play right now as well. And it's, you know, that's the Shakespeare of India. And there's, you know, Molière, the Shakespeare of France. So there's no reason to only just offer Shakespeare all the time. And we do Shakespeare, but we think that the Golden Age of Spain plays, especially because they also have a lot of sword fighting, which is a lot of fun for students to learn and do.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. So if you want to see sword fighting, that will be happening in the show.
How many characters are in the show?
A lot. And I get a little ambitious there, hoping that we can get more community members involved and more students involved. But we also decided to do two shows at once, which kind of cut down on our casting pool. So there will be puppets. Because if you run out of characters, you can always add a puppets. Which they teach you in directing school. They're like, well, if you don't have enough actors, get a puppet. And I'm like, oh, we have those. So, yeah, it's a whole town. The play is a whole town and a whole town that fights for their town. And so our town is living somewhere in Jim Henson. You know, there's people there. There's a little bit of Sesame Street with real people. You know, it's going to be fun.
Jessica, I noted you adapted and directed this particular piece.
Yes, okay. I've been working with his mother, actually, Blanca Lopez in New Mexico, whose first language is Spanish. Yeah, so she's worked on the past couple with us as somebody who grew up reading this stuff. And for her, it's normal. He is the Shakespeare of the Spanish language. And she's like, this is one of my favorites. And one of the first we did was Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz's House of Desires. And she got so excited. She was like, that's the only poem I have memorized is from Sor Juana. I was like, I'm the best daughter-in-law ever.
Nick, now you are directing Fairview.
Yes, by Jackie Siblis Drury, Pulitzer Prize-winning play, very, very current, actually, I believe 2019. This is a play I teach all the time. I teach it both in my theater classes and my intercultural communications classes. A lot of it is based on this idea of perspective and how sometimes that can be misconstrued due to not understanding other people's perspectives. When it comes to walking a mile in someone else's shoes or seeing someone else's perspective, that one thing we forget is that's work. That's hard work. And the play kind of shows what happens when we don't take the time or the pains to really see other people, where other people are coming from, or what they need from us. And this is a sort of a lot of dialogue that's going on in our country today when it comes to sort of race relations, conflicts that we see, to sort of an inability to connect and understand where certain people are coming from. And the way Drury has written it is done in a way that's very satirical and very comedic. It's a very funny piece, you know, and it's a very heartwarming piece at times too. And it goes all over the place when it comes to its tone, its tonality, and its message, you know. And in the end, like any good play, it never fixes anything and never answers anything, just like Ibsen's Doll's House or any other great moving play. All it leaves us with are questions that will then hopefully initiate discussions to help us better connect with each other in the future. The play itself is just fantastic. I love the architecture of it. You know, there are very few plays out there that I can really see. Like, the structure of it is very crucial in the way that it's done. And so you really have to pay attention to how everyone interacts and how they affect each other or how they inadvertently, you know, give off the wrong message. Our actors are great.
How many?
Eight.
Eight.
Yeah.
Eight actors total. You know, so it's not the biggest piece, but they do. It's very much an ensemble piece.
Yeah.
Very much. Sometimes it's very divided and separate, but then it comes together at the end to make this sort of really this cacophony of chaos and miscommunication, which then ends with us just talking directly to the. I don't want to give away too much.
This one you have to see in order to
even reading it can be a bit daunting.
Yeah,
you know, it took me a few reads to be like, oh, I see. So this is definitely a piece that you have to see on its feet to really understand.
Yeah, my elevator pitch for it has always been, it's like watching Family Matters in the 90s. For the first act. And the second act, you're watching people watch Family Matters.
Or the Cosby Show.
Or the Cosby Show, and they're commenting on it while they're watching it. And in the third act, those people commenting on it think they can be in it.
Oh, wow.
They think they understand by watching.
Okay. Yeah. And it was wild, too, because during the pandemic, and when a lot of the riots were happening and a lot of the marches, we reached out to our students, you know, all of us stuck in our houses, reached out to our students and had sort of a BIPOC playwright reading series. We read this one, and I remember this one being the one that was at the end just kind of broke our students. I specifically remember our student who's a local here, Gem Helper, and she just looked at me like, oh my gosh, this is the first play where I feel like somebody sees what it is to be me as a Black woman, a young Black woman. And so for us, you know, our traditional student at SUNY Sullivan, they walk different walks, and we don't always give them, you know, to use the title, the fairest view or the realest view of who they are and who they aren't. You know, there might be some stereotypes that we might apply to them, but until you actually get to know them, you're not giving them that view. Mm-hmm.
And big thanks to Radio Catskill Cultural Reporter Valerie Mancy for giving us that report on SUNY Sullivan's theater program. And that's going to do it for the local edition. We have the daily starting in just a matter of seconds. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.